Well, good morning. Thank you for inviting me back. It's great to be back with you. As I said before, I always admire your openness, your willingness to discuss some of the challenging and difficult issues of being a people of God. I'd like to begin with a cute story about this 83-year-old man who went to the doctors because of some physical pain. And so he walked into the reception area, and the receptionist was there. And she said, "Yes, sir, how may we help you?" And he says, "I'd like to talk to the doctor." And she says, "Fine, but what seems to be the problem?" She says, and he said, "It's my penis." And she said, "Sir," she said, "you shouldn't say it that way." She says, "Look, and everybody here in the reception area is probably a bit offended by that." She says, "You know, what you need to do is you need to come in here and say you'd like to talk to the doctor about a problem you have with a part of your body." And then maybe say, for example, a little bit of the problem, but you don't just blurt it out like that, you know? You understand? Well, he was upset because he had been called on the carpet by her, but so he turned around and he left. He came back about 10 minutes later because he was in so much pain. And he walks up again, and she says, "Yes, may I help you?" He said, "Yes, I'd like to talk to the doctor." She said, "What seems to be the problem?" He says, "It's my ear." And she smiled that he got the message. She said, "Well, what's the matter with it?" She said, "I can't pee out of it." Jokes are a form of storytelling, and that's why we laugh at them, because it's a way of looking at reality and tweaking in such a way that it strikes what we call the funny bone. But actually, what it is about is that we laugh when we see the absurdity of life. We weep when our soul sees the truth of life. And so to be authentically human means we learn and we regularly practice laughing and weeping. Now, unfortunately, in Christianity, we have lots of pictures of Jesus looking very sad, Mary looking very sad and weeping. Very few, though, of Jesus laughing or Mary laughing. But indeed, of course they laugh. Every human being laughs. But we also recognize how important it is for us as people of faith to look at the way we tell the stories about our life. The ways we laugh and we weep together. The ways we reflect upon our lives individually and collectively. In the Jewish Talmud, there's a lovely saying. It says, "God loves stories so much that God created human beings." Is that we are a whole library of stories, each and every one of us. And not just the biographical stories, the resumes, but the interpretation of the stories of who we are. So as we look at stories, we see the three primary categories: creation stories, pattern stories, goal stories. What stories do is they not only inform us, they form us, and they transform us, depending upon how they're told and the perspective in how they're told. In other words, they make us who we are. They make us who we are. Therapy works for some people because therapists help us to see a particular part of our story from a different perspective so that perhaps we can move on. We can forgive ourselves. We can forgive another. We can think of it in a different way. We recognize that, oh, I never thought of that way. A good confessor, a spiritual director can do the same. Certainly a good friend. But stories are what feed our imagination. Now, looking through the lens of our own Judeo-Christian myth, now let me segue in here to my expertise. A myth does not mean it's not true, okay? The most traditional interpretation of the word myth is that it's so true it lasts for centuries. And it speaks beyond the individual person. It speaks to a whole culture and beyond. So a myth, in effect, is a larger truth. So when you use the term or the phrase Judeo-Christian myth, doesn't mean that it's false. It means that it's so true it continues to live in the hearts and lives and stories of human beings. So when we look at the creation story of the Judeo-Christian perspective, it says very simply that we are created by God, that we believe in ultimate mystery, a mystery that's given lots of different names. One title is Creator. So what this says to us is that our origin is divine. Our origin is divine. And when we forget that, as we learned from the first creation story, we become beastly. Okay? The second part of this creation story that we carry in the Hebrew Scriptures is that there is a tragic flaw in every human being in all of creation. If you don't like that term, you can use the term a tragic weakness or impotence or a tragic brokenness. We have used the metaphor original sin, for good or for ill. In effect, whether you realize or not, from the Christian perspective, we've never fully defined what original sin is. We've just said that by our life experience, it exists. So this is the way we write our creation story. Every culture, every belief system has their own creation story of how human beings came to be. The second category of stories are called pattern stories. Pattern stories. These are stories that you notice that come up again and again. Think of them as themes throughout the sacred scriptures that we hold with great reverence, both the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures. So we recognize, for example, that these pattern stories point out to us that great religion teaches us lessons about life and death, how to live gracefully, how to die gracefully, how, in other words, to say, to accept our lot in life with humility, with openness. So, in looking at the scriptures that we hold reverently, we see that half of life is about suffering, and half of life is about joy. So we say this in one of our proclamations of faith: Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again. Or you have the sign of Jonah, right there in the Hebrew Scriptures, that we have something coming out from the depths with new life. Okay? The Paschal mystery of the life, death, and resurrection of Christ is all about a pattern story. It's repeated over and over again. So, the image of God is present in all things, whether it's living, whether it's dying, or that's rising. Or another way to say it, very common language, is at any time in your life, there is something that is living, there is something that is dying, and there is something that is rising. Okay? These are regular, ongoing patterns that Christianity looks at and proclaims. The third and the final area are called goal stories. Goal stories. In other words, what's it all about? You often see this in comics, you know. Tell me the meaning of life. What's it all about? Well, it is a mystery. It's a mystery that we all grapple with. What's your life about? And this is why we have such a need for elders in the community, because it takes sometimes decades for us to reflect upon the meaning not just of life, but the meaning of your life. What does the word meaning have as a definition? In other words, how do you unpack its purpose? Okay? What's it all for? Where are you going with it? So, from the Judeo-Christian perspective, we use stories and images to be able to unpack these goals, to unpack about what's it all about. So, from this perspective, we say the goal is union. And that's why for us as Catholic Christians, the union, the core celebration or worship service for Catholics is communion. Okay? Is that this common union with our divinity, connection with God and with each other, that is the work of the Christ myth. And that whenever you experience union, unity at any level of your life, you are truly celebrating your faith, whether in word or action. So, we don't understand necessarily the goal until we've been wounded, until we flatten our back in a hospital room, or until we're laid off of a job, or maybe when we're retired from a job, when we no longer carry a title or roles. It's then that you begin to discover deeply what your goal is, and how you uniquely live out, from the Christian perspective, the goal of becoming one, in union with. So this is why the mystics teach us from all traditions, but primarily in the Judeo-Christian tradition, that mysticism is learning how to rest in God. To rest in God. That word rest is common to all mystics. In other words, to rest in the fact that you're already in union with God. Read Hebrews 10:10. It's right there. You know, you have nothing to do other than to accept it. To rest in it. Many years ago, Nestle had a commercial that I've never forgotten, where they'd picture this man or woman on a hot summery day, take a glass of Nestle and down it, and just go, and just fall back in a pool of water. Remember that?
Yeah.
That's the image I think of when I come to this. That to rest in God means you don't look around and say, is he going to catch me? Where am I going to go? What's going to happen? You just rest in what is. You rest in the arms of God. So, God doesn't answer any one of Job's questions, for example. Rather, God responds very simply saying, I'm God, and I'm with you. I'm God, and I'm with you. That particular insight from the book of Job was considered the highest level of Hebraic wisdom. Wisdom. From that great wisdom tradition. It's also the very wisdom that's given to us through the person of Christ. When that is his great gift, is to remind us that we have nothing to be afraid of because God is with us. And our life is about communion, about accepting that truth. So the way that we tell our story tells a lot about the storyteller rather than the story itself. So let me give you a quick example here. The way that we individually come into story, of course, is through our own story, our own life experience. We start with my story. In other words, who am I? How do I read reality? So, of course, our story is intimately connected with the story of parents, siblings, relatives, neighborhood we grow up in. Okay? It's called my story. Through your individual story, this is how you perceive reality. This is how you create your value system. Okay? And so, from this point of view, and it's always just a point of view, your point of view, everything is relativized. So this is generally seen as the liberal perspective, okay? Where we always want to hear the story of each person in order to define a category or to be able to make a rule or a law, all right? But there's another way of looking at stories, and that is our story. Okay? And our story can be the story of the family unit, the story of one's neighborhood, the story of one's cultural group, the story of one's gender, the story of one's age group, the story of one's sexual orientation, the story of one's nation, or the story of one's planet. It all depends upon the perspective. So our story is where we create divisions. Why? Because we're necessarily going to fall into, is my story better than your story? Are my people better than your people? And so this is where patriotism, orthodoxy, nationalism, culturalisms, sexism, militarism, all of these fit here because this is where the absolutes are formed. The relatives are formed down in my story. The absolutes come from our story. This is much more the conservative approach. Now, why bring up this? Because both are true. We know that to be true. You know, it's one thing to have principles, but when you listen to the stories of different personalities, things begin to turn a bit more gray. Okay? We're not done yet. We have the story. The story. This is the place of great religion. Okay? Place of great religion. This is where religion, when it's done well, teaches us how to see clearly, even when it gets dark. Okay? Let me repeat that. Good religion teaches us how to see clearly, even when it's dark. Okay? So it teaches us to see, to notice, to observe the patterns in not only one's life, but the patterns of reality. To recognize that in the end, God is the one who is the great mirror of the individual, of the group, of all that is. Okay? So, in light of that, where does history come from? History comes from our story. And that's why to be an historian can be something rather revolutionary. How do you tell the story? How do you get across the facts and figures? How do you pull together the many individual stories? How do you pull together, thus, the our story, the communal story? How do you relate that to the story? Oh, the work of an historian is very important. He or she is given the task of trying to make sense of all the conflicting viewpoints. Is it to be told from the side of the winner, the loser, the folks in between, the median point of view? Let me give you a little example. St. John's Seminary, we have 16 different cultures represented. We also have, as a median age group, the age 36. We have men in their 50s who are studying to be priests. We also have men in their early 20s studying to be priests. Just listening to the stories of these men and them listening to each other is an opportunity for conversion. Conversion of perspective, conversion of insight, conversion of reception. It's a powerful experience when it's done well. When it's not done so well, even humor begins to cut deeply and hurt each other. Okay? For example, on the level of, is one heterosexual or homosexual? Asian or South American? Okay? African or North American? All of these have tremendous impact upon the way that one is able to read reality and receive not only the education that's being offered at St. John's, but the experience and opportunity for transformation. Because at its core, remember, that's what Christianity is about. It's not the same old, but I just mentioned that. It's about transformation. It's about renewal. Or, a more popular word is, it's about conversion. So, let me repeat again. The way that one tells a story tells a lot more about the storyteller than the tale. I'm going to give you a quote from a man by the name of Theodore Zeldin in his book, An Intimate History of Humanity. And he says it this way. What we make of other people and what we see in the mirror when we look at ourselves depends on what we know of the world, what we believe to be possible, what memories we have, and whether our loyalties are to the past, the present, or the future. Nothing influences our ability to cope with the difficulties of existence so much as the context in which we view them. The more context we can choose between, the less do the difficulties appear to be inevitable and insurmountable. The fact that the world has become fuller than ever of complexity of every kind may suggest at first that it is harder to find a way out of our dilemmas. But in reality, the more complexities, the more crevices there are to which we can crawl. I am searching for the gaps people have not spotted, for the clues they have missed. Isn't that lovely? So, this is why I thoroughly enjoy Diana's book. That's exactly what she did. Okay? She came at church history from a very different perspective, similar to what James Martin did in his book about the saints. Okay? She personalized it. She told the stories in a way that touched not only the story, but my story. She readily admitted up front, I want to share with you how it's touched me. James Martin did the same thing in his book called The Life of Saints. Okay? That when we look at stories from different angles and hear it from different voices and life experiences, you wonder, did that really happen? I'm the oldest of 11. When we get together as a family in Verbee, there are some family stories that come up. Okay? And there are times when I sit back, were you in the same family? There's 18 years between myself and the youngest. Remember the sixth oldest, Paul, one day came up to me and says, you know, I'm really jealous of you. And I said, why? And he says, you're the only one that got brand new clothes. The rest of us got hand-me-downs. I said, what makes you think that? He said, well, you're the oldest. I said, Paul, I says, I got used clothing just like you. It's just that I got them from our older cousins. And I got them from neighbors. And I got them from the sisters of the parish. But no, Mom and Dad were equal when it came to that. So even the way that we imagine reality can be misplaced, that we project onto others what we think happened. Okay? And then slowly we begin to create memories that never actually happened.
Yeah.
Okay? Never actually happened. And how many times in your own family structures you've had that happen where you've had a younger sister or brother, or older brother and sister tell you a story? I never heard that story before. You know? You say, but I was there. The person said, you weren't there, you were in college. You know? So we create memories that never actually happened. So, every story, depending upon how it's told and depending upon how it's received, can either liberate us, expand us, or restrict and imprison us. Restrict and imprison us. Okay? So let me give you some ways that we can look at stories in general and move more particularly into history. A story can be told repetitively as a means to protect the literal truth. Okay? So we keep saying it over and over again, sometimes using the exact same words. Okay? I can still hear my mother say, boom, boom, boom. Okay? And it's a way of holding on to it. This is why so much pain is remembered much better than so much joy.
Right.
Because it's burned into our memory and we keep repeating. You're never going to believe what he said to me. And you must have repeated that story 55 times in the space of 4 years. Of course you're not going to forget it. But what happens is it so constricts and imprisons you and the story that you've lost all the context. You've lost all the context. You listen to some of the stories of clients in therapy, you'd think that every single parent on the face of this earth were a bunch of ogres and hated their kids. It's because, as children, we hear it, whatever the experience is, in our worldview. Okay? Because we picture mom and or dad as these huge giants controlling our destiny. Right? Secondly, we can tell a story creatively as a way of engaging the meaning significance of the story. This is where therapy helps. Good spiritual direction, or good counseling, or a good friend. Rather than asking about the details, who, what, when, where, and why, those five questions, why not, well, what did that mean to you? As we say to the seminary in the spiritual direction, where did you discover God in that? See, they're looking for a little support. We don't give them support. What's important is to teach them this level. What's the meaning of it? What's God saying to you in this? Where did you discover yourself in this? Sounds to me like you're trying to make yourself out as the innocent one. I don't believe you. I don't think you're innocent at all. You see? Is that where there's always a mixture of dark and light and gray and everything in between in every one of us. In every aspect of our story. And so the more that we keep telling the story as if I'm the hero and she's the villain, there's no new place to move. If you've never been to a 12-step group, I highly recommend it. It's a refreshing place to be with human beings. Because these are folks who don't in any way try and miscolor, okay, or try and clean up the messiness of their lives. They tell it as it is. Recently, I was at Visiting a friend of mine to support him in his own journey of sobriety. It's been less than a year now. And fellow priest. And he said, would you join me with 12-step? I said, sure, I'd love to. I was moved to tears and laughter during that 1 hour. It was just a great experience. And I heard time and time again, people would stand up and said, I thank God for this group. I don't know where I'd be without it. Have you ever been in a church where you've heard people say that about your church community? I thank God for this group. I don't know where I'd be at. I've never heard that in 30 years of ordained ministry. Never. That tells you what's going on here. Is that when you're only telling a part of the story, people don't believe you. It can't be that good. You know, he can't be that great a husband. All your kids can't be that perfect. You see? And it's not that people are looking for dirt. People naturally want the full spectrum. How do you connect the light and the darkness of your life with your community and with God? How do you find meaning there? Okay? Third, the story could be told as a therapeutic means of healing and reconciliation. This is the way of Christ. Is that however you experience your life, however you experience your pain or your joy or your learning experience, God is always there in the fullness of God's presence. And why, as Catholic Christians, we really focus on the mystery of the real presence. We worship the real presence that we might become authentic, we might become real to others, beginning with ourselves. And so this is the work of Christianity, the work of transformation, of healing, of liberation, of forgiveness. Pick any word you want, it's all the same. That's what Christ was about. Einstein said it this way, the consciousness that caused the problem cannot be the same one that resolves the problem. So this is why God's always trying to help us to look at our story, our life experience, differently. Whether the story is individual, familial, communal, or universal. Because he's offering us a different consciousness, a different awareness, a different opportunity to say, I never thought of that. What a wonderful angle. What a wonderful angle.
There's that word circumspection which comes in a lot.
Absolutely. All the way around. You get a chance to see it from so many different angles, and that's why you want to share your story with others, but not necessarily with like-minded people, but people from different areas of expertise or life experience, where they can say, well, did you happen to think of this? You know? Or, what about this? This is why it's so much fun when people share a dream. Because when people share a dream, everybody has their own insights, and they feel that it's kind of free game. Because it's not real, of course. It's a different level of reality. It's called a non-rationality. But what if we were to do that with our stories? Amongst the Aboriginal peoples in Australia, those living in the bush, they spend 75% of their time doing what we would call dreaming. In other words, they share not only their actual dreams, but then they draw them out, they sing them out, they dance them out, they talk about them, they discuss them. Why? Because they honor both the rational and the non-rational. They want to get a better circumspection of the whole thing so that it's integrated, so that the person and the tribe can be transformed and grow more fully in their humanity. So stories are patterned ways of expressing an internal truth. Certain stories engage us at a deep level because in some way it's a part of our own individual story. Other stories engage us at a larger level, what I'm calling here an our story, a communal story. Okay? That it kind of pads us and says, yes, this is why I'm so happy to be an American, or this is why I'm this or I'm that, because I belong to the group. Okay? And this is fascinating. Just watch people. Now, we're going to have a break in a little bit. Now, watch people come back to the same seat. Have you ever played a game and moved somebody's little item and took their seat and watch and see what happens? We are creatures of ownership. Whether it's territorial or whether it's in the sense of the story, you know, I know it better than you. We've seen this happen politically. I'm more American than you because I've got five flags in my house. You only got one, you know? You see, and it seems silly, but this stuff has a base in reality. And all we're doing is taking a step back and looking at it. Okay? So, stories are a double-edged sword. They can fire our imagination to action, or we can become preoccupied with other people's drama. All stories are true. Some of them actually happened. Let me pause there. And do you have any questions before I get into the first chapter of Diana's book? That's just an overlay or background to help us to step in to this wonderful story of our Christian faith, okay? Her way of understanding it. Clear enough? Okay, good. All right. Robert Bella is quoted here by Dan, and I love that quote. Real community does not forget its past. And indeed, that's true. This is one reason why we keep going back to the story, to name who we are. Okay? Whether it's belonging to a national group, we give a Pledge of Allegiance, or belongs to, like, say, Kiwani, to stand up and talk about the mission statement. You know, we do it as Catholics when we stand up and recite the creed. It's like, we belong here because this is who we are. This is our story. Right? Therefore, she goes on to say, or actually he does, the primary calling of the faith community is to remember. It's to remember. And what Diana does is she implies that we need to remember together. Okay? So, to ask the story, do you remember the background here at Holy Cross? When you first came here, what was it like? And to listen to the members who've been here for a few decades, or to the new members. Okay? People who've been in parishes, people who've been in a parish has gone through tremendous suffering of one type or another. We can't ignore their story. Nor can we ignore the newcomers when they come in. They're so excited. I was first introduced to the RCA process when I was in seminary, and it was a time of great excitement. I mean, we travel all the way down at seminaries, one of our professors down to San Diego, University of San Diego, and studied under Christiane Brusselsman, and we were just in awe of this woman who was like the mother of the movement. It was a great experience. And so I was so excited when I was ordained and got to bring this into parish life. I was in my second parish assignment, and we'd been working with this small group of individuals who wanted to become Catholic. It was about 2 months after the Easter service when I noticed that one of the young gals, she was 19, hadn't been showing up to Mass, Sunday Mass. And she faithfully would come every Tuesday night when we'd meet and come on Sundays and went through everything. And then she disappeared. A year later, she showed up again. And I was standing outside, never forget, I was standing outside the church, greeting people on Sunday after Mass, and turned around there, she said, I said, Diana, it's good to see you. Where have you been? She said, oh, I've been down a couple miles away at another church. I said, another church? What, visiting for what? No, no, I've been going for the last year or so. And I said, really? And this is 2 months after she's been baptized and Eucharized, the whole thing. And I was stunned, and I said, could you tell me why? She said, yeah. She says, you know, after I had all the sacraments, I missed meeting with the same people week after week and listening to the stories. And so I found this church where they do that. That's the way they worship. That's all they do. Isn't that interesting? We must have missed something as a team. But her story, her experience of the faith, is something that's equally important as somebody who's been a Catholic for 50, 60, 70 years. What does it mean for us to listen to her perspective and somebody who's over here and anybody in between? So what I would offer you, for example, in light of what Robert's saying through Diana, what does it say when you look around the room that there's nobody here from generation X to Y? We have World War II, and we have baby boomers, but nobody younger. What does that say? We have nobody of color. So, I have no answers. I'm just asking the questions. We have to ask the questions, you see? So that's what Robert's saying here. Okay? Is that there's a parts of the story that are missing. It's the same thing Diana's saying. When you don't have everyone at the table, the story's not complete. Okay? It becomes skewed.
And that's why history can be tweaked one way or another, depending upon who it's told by and who it's told for. So I like the term that she's used. She says that Christianity is generative. I like that. Okay? That generative Christianity is a different way of telling the story. It's telling the story of transformation through humble service. That this is why people remain Christian, remain Catholic, remain Orthodox. Because the Christ story touches something deep in them. Okay? From archetypal psychology, we would call this, it touches the archetype, the inner sense, the soul that is unique. You know this to be true. You know that you know that you know. Okay? You may not have the words to say it, but you just know it to be true. Okay? It's imprinted on your soul. Alright? There's another phrase that's being used by many different people. I brought three books if you want to look at them. It's called Emerging Christianity. Emerging Christianity. Have you studied this at all? Oh, you have. Okay, good. So, for example, people like Brian McLaren, Jim Wallace, Richard Rohr, Phyllis Tickle, Shane Claiborne, Cynthia Bourgeau. These are all very famous people involved in emerging Christianity. You've probably read Phyllis Tickle's book on emerging Christianity. She talks about the whole flow of church history. Every 500 years, it changes. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So I need to go into that. So, what will this say about the Christian story is that it's evolving. It's evolving. And why I love her definition of tradition. She speaks about tradition being a process of making connections through time. It's a reflective practice that makes history speak in new settings. Okay, I love that. Because when most people use a tradition, whether it's from this perspective, the liberal perspective, or the conservative perspective, has two different meanings. Typically, when the liberals use the word tradition, it means the tradition I like. So, for example, Vatican II. You know, when a Vatican II person uses tradition, it means the tradition I grew up in, and that's the only church I believe in. Okay? Where the conservative, it's like, they mean at least 500, 1,000, 1,500 years ago to an era that they like. It's far enough away that nobody's alive and that they can let it be whatever they want it to be. Give you an example of that. I was at a talk in Hollywood, and a parish invited me to give a talk one evening, and he was talking about some aspect of spirituality. I can't quite remember what it was. And I was leading the people into a form of prayer that today is called centering prayer. But for centuries, it was called contemplative prayer. Anyway, it's called centering prayer. I even had my eyes closed because I was leading the group and I was trying to really be in touch with the Spirit was leading us. And I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll back up. This man raised his hand. He's sitting way at the back where Stan's sitting. And he raised his hand by the question. He says, you know, that doesn't say that here in the catechism, what you just said.
Oh.
And he had it on his lap. And I'm thinking about it. You know, I wonder what catechism he had. Something told me it wasn't the catechism that's even recent. And I looked over and I says, what catechism is that? And he pulled it aside. Turns out it was a catechism that the church used over 100 years ago. And I went up to him at the break and he wouldn't even show it to me. What he was trying to do was to scapegoat me, okay, and catch me in a trap. And so, fast forward it to the prayer at the end of the evening. So I'm leading the people in prayer, and it's all quiet. You could have heard a pin drop. All of a sudden, I heard this, I'm tired of all this Buddhist crap. And he lifts up one of these notes, and he throws it. He's got it this side. He throws it down the aisle, and the clatter, everybody goes, jumps up, you know? And he starts marching towards me. I thought, well, this is going to be interesting to see what happens. Now, thankfully, both the pastor and the woman who invited me, they're both large people. They both stood up, and they just started to walk back to him very non-violently and just kept walking towards him and wouldn't let him come forward. And they just kept walking, and they walked him out. And what he did was, like a little boy, he came around the side of the hall and he kept jumping up to the windows and yelling inside. Why do I mention that? Because He couldn't deal with the perspective of tradition that I was talking about. He was locked in to his read of tradition. It didn't jive with his perspective. Okay? So already Diana is letting us know that she's looking at tradition with a different set of lens. Does that make sense? So let me repeat her definition again. She sees tradition as a process. So since it's a process, it means it's going to be evolving. A process of making connections through time. Therefore, it's a reflective practice that makes history speak in new settings. Okay? Lovely. Very wise. Very grounded in tradition with a capital T, going all the way back. And not limiting it to just a particular voice or even a chorus of voices. Okay? So she goes on to speak, which I find very healthy and helpful for us and for your group. Okay? She speaks about Jesus as the wisdom teacher, as the prophet. Why is this so important? Because once you see Jesus as a fulfillment of wisdom, the embodiment of wisdom, or as a prophet, it allows him to be connected in a whole line of wisdom figures that cross religious lines, that cross denominational lines, that cross cultural lines. Plus, his role as a prophet also opens up a whole other area. In the ecumenical movement, and interfaith movement, there are some denominations and some faith groups that as Catholics we have a greater facility to meet and to be received with greater respect, and others not so well. Okay, we don't do so well with the Muslims, except in one area. Okay, can you take a guess who might be a figure that the Muslims can talk with and understand our language?
Mary.
Very good. It's Mary. It's not Jesus.
Mary.
In fact, if any of you have ever been to Ephesus, at supposedly it's the house that belonged to John and where he brought Mary, there's a little plaque there in Arabic about that. And Muslims come from all over the world to visit there. Why? Because the Muslim people have a great reverence for the mother of any prophet. And Yeshua, Jesus, was seen as a prophet. So they call him Nabu Yeshua. Alright? So they come to honor her, that she was deigned to be gifted to be the mother of this prophet. But they don't honor the prophet. Fascinating, isn't it? Okay? So this is why when we see examples like this, we see that, wow, it opens up the conversation. We can't talk about Jesus directly necessarily, but we can talk about his mother and his prophetic role in the midst of humanity. Alright? So this is an example of what Diana is talking about. That once you open up the edges, when you smooth the edges a bit, you invite more people to the table. And it allows you, me, us, to hear our story in a different way. Another way to look at the person of Jesus, as she points out, is the way of humility, the way of hospitality, the way of love. Okay, she gives that lovely example told through the writing of Justin Martyr of how more people were drawn to the Christian faith not through the martyrs' public witness. For example, today we celebrate the feast of two martyrs who were contemporaries of each other. St. Cyprian and
Cornelius,
thank you. I knew it was another C. I was going through my computer there. I couldn't think of it. Okay, thank you. But the story of the martyrs obviously is an important part of our faith. And many of us, for example, at least I was brought up that the reason the church grew is because it was through the blood of the martyrs. Okay? Well, Justin gives a different perspective. He says, that's not true. It was primarily because the world was turned upside down because now people were not looking at you because of the class you were in, because of your place in society, because of your gender, whether you were free or slave. Rather, they looked at you as another human being, and because of their own humble experience of being human themselves, they would reach out to you in hospitality and love. And people were changed in the spot. This whole practice is carried on amongst the Benedictines. That part of their promise is that they will welcome all visitors as Christ. Okay? That this is part
of their practice, part of their spiritual practice in the way they live out the gospel. And that to this day, strangers are deeply touched. And they get a lot of vocations this way as well. A lot of folks that come and see and say, wow, you do this to everybody? Yeah. Or as Marcus Borg would say, Jesus then also becomes a practitioner of a whole different political realm. Rather than the politics of purity, he practices the politics of compassion. Compassion. To feel with all God's people. To anyone who would come. Mm-hmm. Whether they're Jew or not. Whether male or female. Young or old. That the kingdom he proclaims is the kingdom of nobodies. Nobodies. So now you begin to see the wisdom of what Diana's talking about. You're now inviting to the discussion table the nobodies of the world. The people of no import. Different age groups, different cultural groups. People with color, people with no color. Okay? And that slowly, through this person called the Christ, the story of being Christian begins to change. Or, if you don't like that word, begins to open up. Begins to open up. Now, interesting enough, she says that the early church lasted about 5 centuries. 5 centuries. Well, I must say a little bit, a little disagreement here, in that usually when Catholic Christians use that terminology, they mean the first 2 centuries. But from her expertise as a church historian, she's going the full 5, which is understandable. If you want to really push it, it really was the first 100 years, at least when the majority of Catholics, they say in the very early church, talking about the apostolic era, okay, the first couple of centuries. And Christianity back then was seen not as a doctrinal system, you know, as a creed, this is what I believe in. Rather, it was seen as a way of life. You want to be a Christian? Just walk in the way. Just walk in the way. This is the thing that's hard for us to understand, because we live in a time in Western civilization where everything is so fast. I mean, you know when computers first came out? We thought it was fast if you got it within a matter of minutes. Mm-hmm. And now if it's not a matter of nanoseconds, oh, it's slow. Mm-hmm. See, it's all about perspective and context. Okay? In the time of the early church, now by that I mean the first 5.5 centuries, that people did not become Christian automatically or quickly. For many people, it took years. Why? Because in their wisdom, they knew that since it was a time of transformation, a time of change, that it takes a long time to change. Sometimes a lifetime of habits and attitudes. And so they needed a long time for conversion, formation, transformation, discipline to take place. And it had to take place in community. Had to take place in community. Now, I know you get that. Seminarians don't. I had to say it to them several times every year. Why can't we be ordained? We've been studying 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Because you're still kids, that's why. I didn't say that. The Archbishop said that to him a week ago. And we're all back here all plotting, you know. You know, we have this sense as Westerners that if we just inform this part of our humanity, that's enough. And very often it's this part that gets in the way. It's this part that writes history from a divisive point of view. Right? In the very early church, they were much more interested in this part, the change of the heart. The change of perspective, metanoia, how you see things, how you respond, and how it affects the way you live. How it affects the way you live. It's a lovely story told about, and I'll probably mispronounce his name, but Gurdjieff was a founder of different communities, Christian communities in Europe. And there was this very, very difficult man, just a recalcitrant type, impish type guy. Nobody liked him in the community. And after a while, he got the message and he left. He left. And people were gleefully happy he left. But Gurdjieff was not so happy. He waited about 2 months and he noticed what began to happen, that people were beginning to slide back into this superficial Christianity. And so he went and he sought out this man. He had traveled through Europe and he found him. And he said, why don't you come back? And he says, what for? He says, nobody likes me. He says, I know. He says, I won't lie to you. Nobody likes you. But he says, we are better when you're with us. He said, really? Trust me. So I'll tell you what. I'll give you a stipend each month if you come back and live with us. You're going to pay me to live with you? I'll be there. So he came back. And then when he arrived, Gurdjieff stood up in the midst of the community and announced that he's back. And he was very honest with him. He told him what he did. He said, I've invited him back and I decided to give him a monthly stipend to stay with us. And of course, they were furious. How could you do that? You know how difficult he is? And he waited and let all the fear die down. And he said, I noticed that when he left, you all felt much better and that you felt you were better Christians without him. And it dawned on me that you did not realize that he was our teacher. He was teaching us how to practice compassion, to practice hospitality. We can't do it here amongst believers. How do you expect to do it out in society? He said, did you not say when you came to this community you wanted to learn how to become a Christian? They're all nodding their head. He says, this is the way to do it. You work with people who are difficult, who don't look like you, believe like you, act like you, have the same story as you. And when you begin to get that, then you become another Christ. Wow. Wow. Powerful story. You see, the early church knew that. And that's why everyone was to be welcomed as Christ. Alright? That early Christianity was a message of inclusivity. All are welcome at the table. The nobodies of the world. Now, you'll read about this later in the book, but unfortunately we got away from that. So now we have a whole list of people who aren't welcome, you know, unless you've done this and this and this. And this would be something to study about, but there also was a list that the Hebrews put together, the Jewish people put together, about who was allowed in the inner sanctum of the temple. There were seven categories of people who couldn't go there. We've done the same thing about who's not allowed to the table of the Lord. Very interesting. Okay? Very interesting. The reason that Christianity, when it was practiced well, was so dangerous is because it challenged the status quo of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was built on hierarchical values. Okay? It clearly defined who was in, who was out. Who was above, and who was below. Okay? Who had authority, and who didn't have authority. Christianity comes around and does the opposite. It shows that, or showed that the values of loyalty and family were not to be primary values, at least for people of the way. Rather, love of God and love of neighbor was where they would find common ground. And this is where Diana links it to the present day. That when we look at history of our faith, of the people who have gone before us, of the baptized believers, we can link it to the past with all the stories of the people who have been transformed by the practices of love. So there you have the linkage between my story and the story. That whether we're telling the story of being Christian for those yet to come, or those behind, or those present, if we remain linked there, then we find that common ground. Common ground not only for worship, but also for service. So let's take a break.